Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the Feedback Show. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Hi.
Hello.
You're listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories exclusively on Patreon.
We're here to talk about stories from last month. We had some fantasy action with Conan and a new hero, Imaro. But first, we had a different brand of fantasy action with study number 45, The Bloody Chamber.
John Hazard writes, great story so far. Angela Carter was clearly a fascinating writer in person. I commend you on your commitment to covering more mature subject matter while resisting the urge to nervously giggle about it. Chad's inappropriate jokes are, of course, always welcome. Inappropriate jokes. By the way, I totally thought the Bluebeard legend was about a pirate, as we did.
Yes.
As well, yeah.
Jeremy Impson writes, I'm familiar with the Bluebeard story, and I insist that nothing about it is inconsistent with him being a pirate. In fact, in the time he was away, he was probably privateering against England.
There you go.
That's true. It could have been his job.
Yeah.
We also talked a little about Gilles de Rais in that episode. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Anne Elizabeth wrote, Gilles de Rais was a knight and a companion in arms to Joan of Arc. He was with Joan when the Siege of Orleans was lifted. Noble, knight, hero, and serial killer of children.
Oof. Jim Cannon writes, tying all this back to werewolves, as one should, I first encountered Gilles de Rais in Brad Steiger's Werewolf Encyclopedia. The account of his misdeeds gave me nightmares, even before I was a dad. Grim stuff. But possibly made up? There's some controversy that he was falsely accused and convicted because the church wanted his land.
Oh.
Or because he was so close to Joan of Arc or whatever. Maybe that conspiracy theory was whipped up by someone who could not believe the extent of his crimes. Knowing how serial killers operated in the 20th and 21st century, it's less difficult to believe that de Rais did all that awful stuff. Given how awful it truly was, I kind of want to believe it didn't happen.
Hmm. Darren Hennessy writes, great show. I was reminded of the Bluebeard's Bride RPG by Strix Beltrain, Sarah Richardson, and Marissa Kelly. It was easily one of the scariest games I ever played in. Players take on the roles of different parts of the personality of the bride as she explores the house. And there's a link to it. I've heard about that game. I know people love it. It was kind of the soup du jour a few years back. Everybody was playing this game and loved
really?
It. Really? Yeah, yeah. I never got a chance
cool.
to.
I'm going to have to check it out. Sweatin' to the Great Oldies writes, such a pleasure to have a heroine with agency, personality, and complexity.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Ben Gilbert writes, there are several similar folktales around Europe like the robber bridegroom, the white dove, and Fitcher's bird, most of which feature the keys and the forbidden chamber.
Hmm. Huh, that's interesting. It's in a bunch of different stories.
Yeah.
Bean Planter writes, your mention of the big bad wolf and the woodsman completely changed the way I understand an important scene in Sharknado 1. So thank you for that. Well, I'm guessing, you know, I have seen Sharknado 1. I don't remember much about it, but I'm guessing that the shark's belly gets cut open and everybody springs out perfectly okay.
Wow.
I'm guessing that's what he's referring to.
Or maybe that they don't do that, that they don't spring out of the belly. Because you were talking about how the fairy tales were sort of made a little bit more socially acceptable. And for kids.
Yeah. They didn't end so horribly.
Yeah. And then Sharknado did end horribly where people didn't spring out. Maybe. I haven't seen Sharknado, so I'm not sure.
I like that he has to clarify it's Sharknado 1, not one of the many sequels.
And that brings us to study 46, The Bloody Chamber, Part 2. On the episode, we made some jokes about there being a Galaga machine in the Marquis' secret room.
Yes. And Quantum Chaos wrote, looks over at the Galaga machine in the corner. So Quantum Chaos has the secret room with the Galaga machine.
Oh, wow.
Keep it locked.
Rob Hellfire Graves, cult organ donor, wrestler, poet, and satanic reverend writes, I forgot you were referencing the Galaga arcade game, and I was imagining the Melon Smasher himself locked away performing a private show for an audience of one.
Ah, you thought we meant Gallagher.
Yeah.
No, we did not. We meant Galaga.
Yes.
Common mistake. You know, Gallagher unfortunately passed away just last year.
Mm.
So I guess we could cover his work on the show. The Smash-O-Matic or whatever his hammer's called.
Yeah. Yeah. That's some strange stuff.
Did you ever see Gallagher?
Not in person, no. But of course, he was huge in the late 80s, early 90s.
And he had that whole battle with his brother, was using his name and doing the same act.
What was his name?
Gallagher.
Yeah. They both had the same last name.
And yeah.
They both kind of looked alike. So
I know.
What are you going to do?
What a strange drama that is to have your brother who looks like you stealing your. I mean, that's the movie right there, really. But anyway, back to the story. We discussed how the use of a telephone and other modern references were jarring in the story, and Richard Horseman wrote, I think the phone is there to underline that the ritual is stronger than modernity. It doesn't matter that modern tech and contemporary mores exist. the ritual is still going to play out. Mm. Carter underscores this by having the bride bring up Bluebeard automatons. This makes it explicit that the Bluebeard folktale exists in the world of the Bloody Chamber, but still the story unfolds beat by beat. You know, I remember thinking that was an odd detail when I read it.
Right.
But I didn't think about it too much, no. But that means that the people in the story know the legend of Bluebeard, which is kind of awesome. This is the comment goes on. This is also what makes Carter unpopular in some strands of feminism. She loves the lure of the unhealthy and the lived value found in it, whether it's a tool of the patriarchy or not. Carter once told a student, quote, "My work cuts like a steel blade at the base of a man's penis,"
whoa,
unquote. And that fits the Bloody Chamber. The ritual of marriage, deflowering, discovery, and condemnation is needed to give that moment of Bluebeard's execution true meaning. You could do a cozy horror version of Bluebeard, I suppose, where a contemporary empowered woman saves herself, gets Bluebeard to trial, and puts him through a restorative justice process, where he learns to truly understand his guilt and responsibility. It would go over well with the crowd that reads The Mary Sue, but it wouldn't be what Carter was interested in here. Her work is absolutely feminist, but like Joanna Russ talking about youth sexuality and other semi-forbidden subjects, it's a feminism that gets rejected a lot in the current wave.
Pete Williams writes, "Feminism is such a broad church of ideas. Her work is definitely on the pro-sex side of it, which was probably quite out of step for the time." Jason Thompson writes, "I love the ending of this where the mother appears and kills the sex predator. How could anyone object to that or call it anti-feminist? Mothers have the power to create and destroy life. It's perfect. It's beautiful. I now preemptively dismiss any anti-mother arguments."
Anna Elizabeth writes, any anti-mother arguments. Anna Elizabeth writes, "I really appreciate the analysis, as in not this is what the story means, but this is what the story means to me. I've been criticized for liking Heinlein's Starship Troopers. Huh? For me, the novel makes me think, and when I first read it at age 18, it helped me form an idea of why voting is an important act, for example. That doesn't mean I'm endorsing the systems in the novel, but it does mean I read or listen to the novel about once a year and still enjoy it and get something out of it." Mm. Is the Bloody Chamber feminist? I don't know. Is it intriguing and entertaining, and does it give me something to think about? Yes. I will have to look into more of Angela Carter's works. Mm. Now, that's a good example. I mean, I remember watching that movie, Starship Troopers. I haven't read the book, but only realizing like near the end that it was sort of as subversive as it was, you know, when Doogie Howser is like, "They feel pain. Yay."
Everybody cheered. I remember. Like, the horror.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no, these guys are the bad guys. It was like that.
Yeah, they're fascists.
It's that Mitchell and Webb sketch where the.
Yeah.
The
are we the baddies?
Where they're like, we have skulls on our uniforms.
We're going to have to link out to that sketch if folks don't know what we're talking about. It's a great Mitchell and Webb sketch.
Illegal Structures writes, "I definitely support a feminist reading of Conan." Whoops.
Yeah.
We forgot about that.
We were enthusiastic about that reading of it. And then, there's a naked woman on the poop deck right away. And that just all flew out the window. Mm. It's a Ghost writes, "It definitely crossed my mind that there only ever was one Marquis and that he was impersonating his descendants when the narrator found the book with interesting pictures in it, followed by the passage, 'The Adventures of Eulalia at the Harem of the Grand Turk,' had been printed according to the flyleaf in Amsterdam in 1748, a rare collector's piece. Had some ancestor brought it back himself from that northern city?" I was like, I've read enough of these stories to know he is the ancestor. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was vampiric in some way and replacing himself. Yeah,
that's what I choose to believe.
Anything vampiric about that story, I 100% believe. That was Carmilla. Mm-hmm. He's a vampire. Yep. They're big fans of the Lost Boys in that story. Everything vampiric about it, I believe.
Well, that brings us to Conan time. Study number 47, The Pool of the Black One. David Elwell writes, "Definitely didn't smirk at the immediate mention of the poop deck."
Me neither.
Pete Williams wrote, "Conan is a manic pixie dream boy for straight dudes."
So true. And in this story, the baddies made this young dude do this insane dance that we were laughing about.
Oh, right, yeah.
The dancing. And Jeffrey Cars wrote, "Why, when REH got a time machine, did he use it to watch me dance?" That was always you.
Makes sense now. Falkenhoof writes, "During the passage where the young sailor is compelled to do a joyless, lascivious dance against his will, I was picturing him doing the Macarena."
Oh, God.
Crying as he does it.
Wolf Mungus writes, "My favorite exchange of this episode. Chris, this reminds me of the dancing plague of 1518. Chad, okay." I don't know if that was the exact delivery. Also, I must insist that all future readings of Conan be done in Southern accents. You got it.
Oh, all right. Greg Needham writes, I'm sorry, but the fact Chad didn't know about the dancing plague was frankly shocking.
I mean, maybe I've heard of it before. I haven't heard it brought up casually in conversation like you did very frequently. But there's a Bauhaus song that I like called St. Vitus Dance. Oh. And now I know what it's about. It's about the dancing plague. Because that is also called St. Vitus Dance.
Yeah.
Christopher D. Singles writes, I believe that the black giants causing the naked pirate boy to dance in a sinful, lascivious manner could actually be a racist take on jazz, just as rock and roll was branded jungle music. Yeah, we mentioned that might be what it is in the episode. Don't let your white children be exposed to this menace. They will become hypersexualized and smoke marijuana cigarettes. It could be.
It could be, yeah. Doug McCool writes, I've really struggled as I get older to get angry or dismissive of things that I've loved for so long being described or exposed as racist. I suppose it's a defense mechanism, like someone just called your kid ugly. Of course, I absolutely see why elements of old stories and TV shows are seen as such, but I generally don't recoil from the story. I know it's there, I roll my eyes, and I move past it. It's one thing when the bad guys do bad things, but it's another when your protagonist does it. Perhaps there's some fear that someone will accuse me of supporting those ideas in some way. I definitely need to work on being able to discuss that about these stories without feeling such a strong need to defend them. In my experience with Conan, he seems like he'd be the last person to underestimate someone based on whatever the Hyborian concept of race would be. He called those pirates slash sailors a race, but that's more of a culture, right? Anyway, great to see Conan back on the show again. Plenty more out there to pick from. Happy Thulai.
Andrew M. Reichart writes, I think it's incredibly valuable to be able to enjoy a thing from one perspective and critique it from another. It's important to be honest about the role racism played in the past for plenty of reasons, but especially in order to be honest about the role it plays today.
Yep.
Now, remember, after making the young boy dance, whom we've just identified as our listener, Jeffrey Carr, the baddies in the story shrunk him down into a little figurine,
yeah,
which we couldn't explain. Uh-huh. Also, the sailors' weapons had all been collected while they slept. And DR wrote, if the action figure theory is correct, then maybe the beings collected the pirates' weapons so they could pose them with the weapons before shrinking them.
Oh, yeah, makes sense.
Absolutely.
Jim Cannon writes, it's obvious, at least to me, that Two Gun Bob was a huge Edgar Rice Burroughs fan. Conan is visually a complete clone of Tarzan, of course, and even has Tarzan's superhuman animal senses along with his superhuman strength and ability to tan without ever getting a sunburn despite being from Northern Europe. This story in particular, out of all Conan stories with its casual nudity, not just of the lone lady character, but also the giants and the sailors and even Conan for the most part. Just breeks, like loincloth, eh? Reminds me so much of Barsoom. Even the weird Jade City and the pool of the gigantic aliens would fit neatly into one of Burroughs' planetary fantasy novels. I know Howard was using sex to sell his stories, but I think he was also falling back on the stuff he read as a kid, too.
Yeah, Barsoom is the planet and John Carter of Mars. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of Edgar Rice Burroughs as a kid as well. He's somebody we got to get into at some point.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I want to do a short story by him. Most of his stuff is longer. I mean, maybe we even just want to tackle a Tarzan novel. I would love to go back over one of the ones that I read when I was a kid, because I'm sure I would have a way different perspective on it now.
Yeah.
Because I was pretty young when I read those.
I read John Carter of Mars for the first time maybe about 6 years ago, 7 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And it's pretty good. It moves at a good clip. It's a rip-roaring kind of adventure. There's neat stuff in there. I was surprised by it. I really enjoyed it. So I think that might be possible material for the show.
Well, it influenced so many things that we've read in the past, John Carter of Mars specifically. Mm-hmm. And it's influenced so many things just in pop culture that we don't realize. It's interesting that when the Disney adaptation of John Carter of Mars finally came out, people felt like it was derivative.
Yeah.
Of all of the things that were actually derivative of John Carter of Mars. Yeah. You know, it's strange when that happens. Mm-hmm. Dan Pratt writes, abbreviation of pants, talking about Conan silk breaks.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Conan had this line near the end of the story, telling the girl to kiss him. Jamie Britton wrote, I'm appending a kiss line to every story from now on. Quote, Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther. And one fine morning, now come here, girl, and give me a kiss. He's got it. Jamie's right. It works at the end of Gatsby.
Yeah, it's everything. It's perfect.
So it should work at the end of everything.
Feedback 12, Muppets Moreau. Anna Elizabeth writes, I just thought of this regarding songs inspired by Moreau, and that awesome Muppets idea, my favorite song from the band Blondie is the Calypso-style Island of Lost Souls. Is it called Island of Lost Souls?
Yeah.
I know that. It's a great song. I didn't realize that was the title of it, though.
I
don't think the song was really inspired by H.G. Wells, but the video has fishmen playing brass instruments and then a sequence where Debbie Harry seems to be lost in a foreboding jungle. So anyway, maybe this song would work in the Muppets parody y'all mentioned.
I know that song, but I didn't even think about the connection. I've never seen the video. Fishmen playing brass. I got to check that out.
Well, maybe it was one of these things where it was actually the movie that inspired the song and not the original book, because Kate Bush hadn't read Wuthering Heights. She had seen the movie Wuthering Heights, and her song Wuthering Heights was based on the movie, not necessarily the book.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so disappointing. We probably said that back when we were covering it. It really actually disappointed me just now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hayden Orr writes, in regards to the bonus episodes being video and unedited, I absolutely do not mind the non-edited nature, as you guys already do a lot for the show. Mm. And anything you need to do to give yourselves a break or make your workload a bit easier is fine with me. However, I do have to admit that I often completely forget that there's a video component as well.
Yeah.
That's mostly why we ditched that side of it. And as with the Manimal episode from last month, we're going to continue doing the bonus episodes as lightly edited features, trying to save some time for ourselves. But I appreciate that.
Rafe Ball writes, over the years, you guys have covered many sanity-blasting stories and tales of terror to shake the soul, but I don't think I've ever encountered such a horrifying concept as the prospect of you covering Eat, Pray, Love.
Well, luckily, it's not going to happen.
No.
On that feedback show, Hayden Orr was hipping us to some comics in which Dr. Moreau or his creations make an appearance, and he included a Weird West comic called West of Sundown. We got a comment from Aaron Campbell, which says, hey, I co-wrote West of Sundown with Tim Seeley of Hack Slash fame. Our whole conceit was that Moreau came to the American frontier prior to going to his island, thinking it would offer the isolation he seeks, as well as a ready source of dispossessed peoples to experiment upon, those people being the Pueblo and Diné population of northern New Mexico. In this first stage of his experimentation, his focus was, much like Prendick's early assumption, the grafting of animal parts to human subjects. But thankfully, a beautiful Latinx vampire, an Irish defector from the Confederate Army, Frankenstein's monster, and a 15-year-old future invisible man saved the people of northern New Mexico from the exploits of the psychopathic Dr. O. Also, Azathoth shows up. It's a real hoot.
Aw, that's great.
Hey, that's awesome. Everybody, please go check out Aaron Campbell's
West of Sundown.
West of Sundown. How cool that he listens to the show. People, you should pick that up. The thing that I'm the most confounded is the Irish defector from the Confederate Army. Frankenstein's monster, the vampire, invisible man, no big deal. But I'm like, how did an Irish guy fall in with Southerners? I got to pick it up.
That makes sense. No, I know Aaron Campbell personally. I've met with him. He comes to the UK for a great comic book convention, Thought Bubble. He reached out, been a fan of our show forever. I'm a fan of his work as well. He's a talented artist and a writer as well. So I see him all the time. Well, once a year, if that counts as all the time. It's a Ghost writes, hey guys, I took your advice and watched the 1931 version of Jekyll and Hyde, and woo-wee, you were right. That was definitely disturbing. Really great, but also disturbing.
It's a good one. Frederick March, best Jekyll.
It's true. Study number 48, Amudu's Bargain. Briar Ripley Page writes, you guys should definitely check out the works of Samuel Chip Delaney. You won't be able to cover him on the show yet, though, as he's still very much alive and on Twitter.
Yeah, we were quoting the author Charles Saunders mentioning him, and after the show, you emailed me and said, hey, this dude is alive.
Yeah, we
should try and recruit him to talk on the show.
That would be awesome.
Sweatin' to the Great Oldies writes, now this I found far, far better than any Conan covered so far. All the badassery without the no-classery. See, they should have used that tagline on the book instead of the Black Tarzan line.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have had any problems. Jason of the K writes, hey, I don't know about that. There was only one reference to cat-like. How am I supposed to get drunk reading non-Panther stories like this? And that wasn't all Jason had to say.
Jason goes on to say, I think you guys got poor Amudu all wrong. He had made a bad bargain with a demon and it cost him his daughter. Now he's trapped making pretty things for the demon's private collection, praying for salvation in the form of the demon's death. But those soft-handed artist fops coming in weren't going to cut it. When Amaro shows up, he thought he was saved. Then Amaro says he's done killing demons and stuff. So Amudu had to use his keen human insight to realize that Amaro might not kill on request, but would if he was baited by a damsel in distress rescue mission instead. So he concocted the tale and sent Amaro on it, hoping for the sweet release of death.
Well, that's one way to look at it. And Jason was clearly not drinking during the story, which allowed him to come up with that interpretation.
Yeah, true.
Jeremy Impson responded, "That's plausible, but doesn't change the fact he willingly sacrificed his daughter in order to voluntarily enter this deal, not to mention sent Amaro into danger on false pretenses."
Yeah.
I mean, Amudu didn't necessarily know his daughter was going to get snapped up, I thought, at least in the way that he told the story.
Yeah, it could be that was... I mean, he's not necessarily a reliable narrator either.
Look, we'd all like to rehab Amudu, but the headwinds are against us.
Yorick DeVetter writes, "Great story and awesome reading. Kudos to Osahan." Yes, she did a phenomenal job.
Agreed.
She's a great... And a great person.
Yeah, we got to have her on more often. Mm-hmm. I thought that reading was really outstanding. Ben A. writes, "Glad you all found the Sword and Soul store 2 doors down from the Zathik Boutique in the Strange Stores section of the Mythos Mall. I heard a rumor that Curious Goods is moving into the mall sometime soon."
Oh, nice.
"To echo others here, you absolutely should read more Amaro stories, whether for the podcast or just for yourselves. The first Amaro book consists of a few, I think 5 or 6 short stories, and would make a great Saunders month." Mm-hmm. "Kind of like when you did the Sword and Sorcery Tales of Howard back in 15. Back in 15. Saunders is more than the anti-Howard, though, as he brought a lot of complexity to Amaro's backstory, which you only learn in small pieces across all his tales, especially in The Quest for Kush and The Epic Trail of Bohu. I read these a couple decades ago, and they still remain among my favorite of the broader sword and sorcery genre."
Oh, wow.
"And if you like those, check out his broader Niobani universe tales, especially The Silent Ghosts." Yeah, you better believe it. When I'm at the bookstore, he's on the list now. I'm snapping up everything I can find because I'm really interested in the development of these characters. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that specific recommendation, though.
Thank you. Extra credit, Manimal, Breath of the Dragon. And Knight writes, "I managed to live through the 80s. I was 23 in 1983. Without ever hearing or watching Manimal. Thank you."
If you're 23 in 1983, then of course you didn't know about Manimal because you were old enough to know better.
Yeah.
We were not.
Well, you could like leave the house.
That's right. You could leave the house. At 23, you're not watching any television. I wasn't.
I hope not. You know, you should be out having a good time.
Yeah. Murder, She Rotenberger wrote, "Are we not Manimal?" Which pleased me.
Yeah, that's good.
Richard Horseman writes, "I watched the highlight reel and was delighted to hear incidental music that Chad has sampled for some projects. Almost an Easter egg." Uh-huh. Ha-ha! Yeah, a couple people found that. And it was funny until I watched the episode. I didn't even remember that I had done that. But that specific album, Monster Party, has a few songs where I did some sample. It's not something I do all the time, but yeah. The soundtrack for that is great. And I actually also sampled on that album the Brady episode, the two-parter where they went to Hawaii, is also on that album.
Oh, right.
I went sample crazy.
Eric Gordon writes, "Holy moly, I just watched the clips on YouTube. Thanks for the reminder that I need to practice my karate in my basement where no one could see me. Chef's kiss to you."
Reminder. If you look at his calendar, "I was going to do that Friday. I'm glad I heard the show." Stay down here.
Ravi H. writes, "Chad, every 10-year-old has nunchuck fever." It's true. Victor Badger writes, "As a former teenager who owned nunchucks, I feel compelled to mention my strong belief that they are far more dangerous to the user than to any opponent. If I had a dollar for every teen, myself included, who hit themselves in their genitals with their nunchucks, I would be able to pay for a Manimal reboot."
Jason Rainbird writes, "For a Manimal reboot, who would you all cast? I would love to see Matt Berry as JC." Matt! Matt Berry would be an awesome Manimal if you're just going the straight comedic angle.
Yeah.
The problem is, it's already funny. Like, this is one of those things, and I think we probably mentioned it in the show, but there's so much content that makes fun of that 80s action era. But this is the best parody of it because they didn't know they were doing a parody of it. I mean, I'm sure they had some idea. It was silly. But it is just, sometimes you can't make fun of something that's already making fun of itself. So I would not know how you would do a Manimal reboot. I do think that Will Ferrell's production company had one in development for a while.
They were. Yes, that's true.
Some kind of movie. But I would guess that enough time has passed that Manimal awareness is at an all-time low. Not among our listeners, but culturally, that's a long time ago, man.
Well, the whole point of doing a reboot is to capitalize on people liking it and being into it, and they'll want to go see it because they like the original source material. But if nobody right. knows the source material, what's the point?
Well, I think probably they did that Land of the Lost movie that Danny McBride and yes. Will Ferrell are in, uh-huh. and it kind of bombed, and they went, oh. Or that Lone Ranger movie that came out.
Oh, man.
They're like, we can't get the kids with this stuff because they don't get the reference. They don't care.
Ola Romanu writes, I put this on in the car on a road trip. My wife looked at me and asked, what on earth is this? This is chaos. So thank you for that. Then later I showed her the highlights reel. Date night, done right.
Yes. I'm so glad we put that highlight reel on YouTube. I was afraid they were going to kick it all back. They did in some territories. If you're a French listener, you can't watch it.
No.
But in America and the UK, you can check it out. And I still think people should because it is ridiculous.
It's crazy.
Can you imagine hearing a synopsis of Manimal and having no awareness of what it is at all? It would be chaos. What's going on? Jeremy Impson writes, oh, the sweet freedom for Manimal was in our sight. Also, they found an excuse for one more again, and I fear they will continue to find excuses to torture us. Just kidding. I love it. Maybe there's a novelization you could cover.
What?
I do think there are comic books.
The Manimal comic books?
Yeah, I think there are. It's going to be a while before we circle back around to Manimal, but yeah, there's one more episode and then the Nightman crossover. And then what did you find? Are there Manimal comic books?
Yeah, there was.
Well, that's literature, so we have to cover the Manimal comic books. Okay, Jeremy, we're going to see if we could track that down.
We'll
you
see
accidentally gave us a reason to continue your torture. Well, that's all we have for the feedback show. It was a really fun month.
Yeah, there's lots of great stories and lots to talk about. And thank you guys for taking the time and writing in some good comments and bringing us some joy. So I appreciate that.
Yep, that's all we got. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackett. You've been listening to Feedback Show.
At Strange Studies of Strange Stories, exclusively on Patreon. Good night.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.